Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
You see, you didn't use your radio voice. You're always getting on me for not using my radio voice. I used my radio voice, and you just said, Jeff, just saying. I'm trying
Jeff
to be...
Jeff McClure.
I said that. There you go. I said the whole... Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Yeah, it's just you have a disadvantage there in that I actually heard radio when people had radio voices. I used to listen to radio because we didn't have a television.
Yeah, but I watch A Christmas Story every Christmas, and they sit in front of the radio on that.
But it's still a little different. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure.
Where one of them may be heard to say, well, it's not as exciting as I thought it would be, actually.
You think anybody's actually listening?
I know I'm not.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
By the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's in case you didn't know that was the name of this radio program.
We've only
the Personal
said it
Wealth
four
Coach.
Times, so it's fine.
People are a little slow sometime on Saturday mornings. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a radio program, I think.
We hope.
We have on good authority from sources we deem reliable. It is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which implies in no way that they approve of us or disapprove of us, just simply says that is our primary regulator and that is who through whom we are registered.
Yeah, this is a simple statement that should kind of preclude all of that. Economists should never imply that anybody like them. See?
Or approves of them.
Or approves of them in any way. Because
on the other hand,
they're economists. But on the other hand, you know, but yes, economists have lots of hands. We're at least eight. We're trying to compete with the octopuses.
Yeah.
All right. The next,
okay, so we,
next one is that just because we're registered with the SEC
to
provide investment advice, that's what the whole registration is, doesn't mean we can give investment advice on the air. So why do we even say it? Well, because you have to know who we're registered with. And if we do give investment advice on the air, that's probably a really bad thing. Why? Because it's not private on the radio, one. Two, if I give one of you advice, it's probably bad advice to somebody else. It's kind of like going to the eye doctor and having them take the glasses off their face and say, here you go, these worked well for me. It seems logical, but probably not. So we're giving education, not investment advice on the air. We're telling you how the glasses work, not giving you a prescription on what your eyesight needs to be adjusted to.
Now, you're welcome to come in for an examination.
Yeah.
And we will fit appropriately designed fiduciary standard eyeglasses to your portfolio.
Yes. Yes. But it's not really a good thing to do on the air. So that was really not a disclosure. That was more like a explanation of a disclosure. But that's good enough. So I know we're supposed to disclose in as few words as possible, as quickly as possible, and in a monotone, so that there's absolutely no way that you can understand the stuff that the regulators believe it's vital for you to hear and understand.
But if you say them really quickly, you've met the requirement.
Yes, that's all you need.
All right. Yep. Anyway, let's go on with our disclosures. So
yes, next disclosure is yours. Because you'd like to
the information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or reliability of said information.
Nice. We don't pay for this radio program.
We don't?
No, we don't pay them, and we don't get paid for it either. We've been doing this since 1997, and we do advertise on the studio's airspace to support the radio program. So we give all of our advertisement is for the radio program. And then the studio also advertises for the radio program. Go ahead.
We do mention ourselves on the that we exist.
Yes.
On the radio program and give our telephone number. So that is a form of advertisement.
Yes. There is a form. Well, I mean, we're talking to you. You hear our voices. You're probably going to Well, I don't know. That's a bit of an assumption for me to say that they would like what they hear. That's a big stretch. This may be the worst advertisement possible. They hear us talking and they go, whoa, those two bald guys just can't shut up. I'm not going to go talk to them.
There's probably a lot of truth in that.
So we may have lost more clients than we've gained through doing this radio program. We'll never know. Try to prove the negative. Mm-hmm. But now we can move on to what's actually happened this week.
Well, it was an interesting week in the equity markets, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, but it was even more interesting in the bond markets. As a matter of fact, all the markets were kind of interesting this week. Boredom was not a problem. That was anything else you want to know?
Boredom is a problem? Not a problem? What?
Not a problem.
No. No, it was excitement levels were a little high.
The S&P 500 stock index was cruising along around 4,100, very much where it closed last week and not doing anything particularly interesting until sometime Thursday, which I thought was interesting. In the middle of the afternoon on Thursday, it started sinking rapidly.
By the way, the news didn't come out in the afternoon. It came out in the morning.
The next morning.
Right.
Yeah, it came out on Friday morning. And so I think that there's some leakage at the Labor Department or something.
Yeah.
But it started falling. And then when the Labor Department announced, actually the Bureau of Labor Statistics, announced that for the trailing 12 months, the United States Consumer Price Index was up 8.6%. The market said, let's go south. And when I say the market said, actually, it was probably a bunch of algorithms. And there's a really good reason it did that. Other than I didn't see, oddly enough, I didn't see any evidence in the selling of general fear or panic. What I saw as I watched the selling go on during the day was Al Gore.
Algorithms. Yeah. He's got some rhythm sometimes. If you just plug the math in, he has a beat
because
to him.
It was kind of funny to watch it. You have to be a real geek. It dropped down to 3,900 and just stayed there, bobbing up and down just the tiniest bit. In other words, it's like somebody had programmed a computer that says, okay, if we get higher inflation than we anticipated, drop from 4,100 to 3,900 and stay there. And it did. And I thought that was kind of interesting, to say the least. And if I read some articles on it by people whose math is a lot better than mine, and they explained that the total earnings for the S&P 500 are anticipated to be this, this, and this going into the future. And there's this peculiar thing that if you're an accountant, you understand fully. And if you're an economist, you understand somewhat. And if you're a normal human being, you think is pure gobbledygook and magic, and that is present value.
Yeah. And the normal person, non-accountant, non-economist may be saner for having opinion, by the way.
Yes. Or more sane, as the case may be. What happens is interest rates rise. And by the way, inflation is an interest rate. If we look at future interest rates being up or inflation being up, then the current value of a stream of money coming in drops. And it drops a very specific amount with the anticipated rise in interest rates. And that's how far the S&P 500 dropped. It basically said, okay, at 8.6%, the future earnings of the big companies in the S&P 500 are worth less today than they were when it was 8.2% or 8.4%, and we'll drop that far. And it did.
So
it was quite, actually pretty rational.
Yeah, it was very rational, which is quite irrational because the market's generally not algorithmically rational in a given day. It's about as opposite as rational can be in a given day. So
did you
to watch
say Al Gore was rational?
I said his opposite of as Al Gore's rhythm, if he has one.
Okay, just checking.
So, I mean, all right. I'm not to, it is an inconvenient truth, but his rhythm really is not that great.
Okay.
I'm trying to stack the puns, and man, are they stacking so horribly.
They're good. Well, actually, the fact that he has such a good name for it, I mean, that's the only reason I remember. I mean, he was a vice president. You don't remember vice presidents very long. And he lost in his run for presidency. And you don't remember losers in runs for presidency very long. But I remember Al Gore very well because he has such an interesting name.
Well, he invented the internet.
Invented rhythm. Invented the algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, the guy.
Yeah, he's cool. Anyway, the analysts immediately and pundits came out and said, okay, this means that we will see 3.5% rises in the Fed funds rate in the next through September. There's an anticipated, there'll be a break in there.
So so let's say that again. You'll see 3.5 rises.
Right.
That's three different 0.5 rises, not 3.5 rises.
Right. Three
separate half-point rises.
Well, they'll do half points. There is discussion, as everybody follows every tiny word that a member of the Federal Reserve Board says now, a voting member, there'll probably be a break in September when they don't raise interest rates and watch to see what happens. Somewhere in there we'll get three, but the consensus among the people who are Fed watchers, and there is an entire profession of being a Fed watcher now, apparently, is that around the end of the year, short-term interest rates, the Fed funds rate, is there now, which it currently is at 1%, will be at 3.25%. Now, what else is holding the market down then? Well, if short-term rates are 3.25%, there are, and longer-term rates continue to rise as well, which they have been doing as the Fed unwinds its balance sheet, which is a mixing of metaphors, shrinks its balance sheet. There are quite a number of companies in the S&P 500 whose debt service is pretty high. They have a lot of debt. And as interest rates go up, they roll their debt over monthly. They've been having very short-term debt because very low interest rates. And they're called zombie companies because at the very, 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 very low interest rates we've had in the recent past, they could just keep borrowing money. And they are keeping borrowing money. But as interest rates go up, their interest rate, their service, the interest they have to pay for the debt they have will probably exceed their profits, which is not a good thing for a company or its stock value.
That means that you don't have profits if your profits all go away being spent on things to keep your business open.
Right.
I know that's hard to understand, but that's really what that means.
Well, if you haven't been in business, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but yeah. I understand. Basically, if you've borrowed so much money on your credit cards and your mortgage and everything else, that just the interest payments, not counting the principal, are eating up all your take-home pay, you just got to keep borrowing more money on the credit cards. And at some point, you either get a better job and get more pay or you are in deep trouble.
Yeah, people stop loaning you money at some point.
Right. Well, maybe.
And this is part of what's happening as well. You can see it in the mortgage market. The Fed's also, when you said unwinding, which is a beautiful mixed metaphor, unwinding its balance sheet, because a balance sheet is supposed to be like a piece of paper and a winding is like a clock. Are you winding
it's a piece of paper. Have you ever taken a piece of paper and just kind of twisted it and turned it into a tight little tube?
Twisting it.
And they're basically letting the tube unwind right now.
What the Federal Reserve has been doing for several years since the pandemic really hit is that they have been buying mortgages as well as U.S. government bonds. Well, what does that have to do? Why are they buying mortgages? What does that have to do with anything? Well, if you went to buy a house or refinance your mortgage and you said, I need to go through the process of getting a loan, the bank looked at the market and said, somebody's going to buy this as soon as I give it to you. I'm going to get this, you, your mortgage, and then it's going to get bought. And everybody knows that's what happens. Within a week of getting a mortgage, somebody else is servicing it. You get a letter saying, like, it's a very formal thing where they tell you you're still being charged by the same people, but it's going through a different thing, and you're going to have to...
That's just the servicing.
Yeah, that's the servicing. So the servicing has a fee that goes with it. But on top of that, the loan itself gets purchased by someone.
Right. And it goes in, this is the point, because it's summer, it goes into a pool.
Yes, because it's hot out. So you got to go into the pool. Right.
And so they put the mortgages in a pool.
This is a step up. They used to be called tranches, which just sounds dirty if you're swimming in them. I went swimming in the tranches. It was muddy, but that's why I went swimming. Well, now it's in the pools.
Well, actually, the pools are made into tranches. That's where they dump the pools.
Right. So all the pools go in the tranches.
And they sell them as bonds.
Yeah.
And the Federal Reserve bought a bunch of the bonds, which, as I was talking about, the balance sheet that they twist up and tighten.
That winding thing.
Well, as they squeeze that balance sheet,
They're not buying bonds anymore.
I'm going to take, as they keep tightening.
You're going to keep mixing the metaphors. No. Let's get them mixed together.
I'm going to go on with this metaphor.
Okay.
They're going to unwind it as they continue to wind their balance sheet. It squeezed money out into the economy.
Yeah.
And as they unwind their balance sheet, it sucks money out of the economy and causes longer term interest rates to go up.
Yeah. So when you go to get a mortgage now, you may have noticed that the interest rates are a bit higher.
5.25.
That is 2.25 higher than it was just 6 months ago.
Right.
It's huge. It's nearly double what it was 6 months ago. Why? Well, what is that about? Well, when the bank goes to make you a loan, they're not as sure that somebody's going to buy the loan from them as soon as they're done. You know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are standing out there buying loans. Well, the Federal Reserve was standing out there with them. So three big pigs at the trough, ready to eat up any loan that came to them. Well, one of the pigs is regurgitating.
Oh boy, you didn't have to do that.
I'm trying to mix as many of these.
No,
just kind of making us ugly. So the Federal Reserve is not only not buying, they're selling the mortgages that they already bought, which means there's less money to go around. They're putting money on the market rather than buying stuff on the market. They're putting the mortgages on the market. So go ahead.
Now that we beat that particular horse to death, after
wait a minute, that's the last analogy to add to the pigs at the trough on the unwinding of a balance sheet
and beating a horse to death in a hot summer sun.
Yes, in a pool with a trench. Yes, let's go ahead.
The CRSP mid-cap value. Well, first off, the Standard Poor's 500 stock index dropped 5.05% for the week. It is now 18.61% from its record high back in the beginning of January, which leaves it still in correction territory. It's not a bear yet. It's 7.98% lower than it was a year ago. Now, let's go to the other side of the stock market. Well, not the complete other side, but somewhat to the other side. We follow the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. It dropped 5.16%, which is more than the S&P 500 did, to 2355.8. Now, it's down 9.3% from its record high, which means it's not even in a correction yet. It is down 5.64% from this time last year. So, but let's go back to the S&P 500, and this is in our newsletter. This is an important perspective, I think, to keep in mind at this point. I think people are doing that. The three-year average annual return, that takes us to before the pandemic.
So before this massive crash and unexpected distortion, before the war in Ukraine, before all these other things.
Before the pandemic.
So these bad things happened since then. What has been the average?
Our average annual rate of return in the S&P 500 for the last 3 years is 12.95% a year.
That's like 13%.
Well, it's close. And that's not bad. It's exceptionally good, as a matter of fact. And if you measure from the last time the markets got scary, which was in 2020 in March when the pandemic was hitting and the markets were in free fall and the headlines were screaming, bailout, now the world's coming to an end. The S&P 500 is up 74%, even in a correction. In other words, from our perspective as long-term investors, is the market up or down? It's up. If you're looking day to day or a few months at a time, it's down. And that is the nature of the history of the United States equity markets. Long term, they're a great place to be. Short term, they are sometimes extremely frightening. So that's the reality there. Now, RBC Capital Markets. Now, it's now called RBC Capital Markets. It used to be Royal Bank of Canada, but now it split off from the Royal Bank. Now it's just RBC. It's like so many other things where the letters used to mean something and now they're just letters. RBC Capital Markets, which is a very well-respected investment commentary advisor bank-type firm, they issued a report this week that the S&P 500 will end the year at about 4,700, which is a little lower than they had said before. Now, why is that important? Because that's 20% higher than it closed on Friday. And as the various investment banks, Goldman Sachs, RBC, JP Morgan, as they have issued their estimates of where the market, this S&P 500 will be at the end of the year, it's in that ballpark. These guys are not always right, but they ain't stupid. And they have a really good feel for what's going on in the economy. And they have some really high paid people and a bunch of them that have a lot of studies and a lot of degrees and a lot of numbers. And so let's hope they're right. There's no guarantee. The future is always uncertain. Man, is the future uncertain. And 4,700 sounds really, really good, but that's not a record high. It still won't be back to where it was in January. It'll just be 20% higher. If they're right, it'll just be 20% higher than it is Friday. So I find that really pleasant. Normally at this point in a falling market, and I've gone back and looked at my history here, if it's a bear, you have the big investment bank saying, doom and gloom. The end of the year will be much lower than it is today. Go hide in a hole someplace. So I am somewhat comforted by this. Again, there's no guarantee that they're right. Okay, moving on. The U.S. Treasury note, 10-year U.S. Treasury note. When the inflation news came out, it did exactly what you would expect an interest rate-bearing security index to do. It rose to 3.162%. The Treasury yield curve, which is normally pretty prophetic about what's going on in the economy, is very close to flat at this point. The 30-year bond is yielding 3.169. Again, the 10 years is 3.162. The 30-year bond is 3.169. Whoa, that's close to flat. The 2-year note is at 3.065. So everything's above 3%. There's still a slightly positive slope to the curve. And by the way, if the curve goes negative for a short period of time, historically, it means nothing. It needs to go negative for about 2 months, and then we will start to worry. The S&P 500 bond index, you know, is the bonds. And there's lots of indices about bonds, some of which are more reliable, some of which are less reliable. But since we talk about the S&P 500 stock index, let's talk about the S&P 500 bond index at the same time. The S&P 500 bond index is a compilation of the bonds issued by the S&P 500 companies. So we've got apples to apples or sort of here. It has fallen 11.24% over the last year. Remember, I just said that the S&P 500 has fallen 7.98. The bond market has fallen significantly more than the stock market. The 3-year return, remember, of the S&P 500 is 12.95%. The 3-year return holding the bonds of the S&P 500 companies, total return with interest reinvested is 0.57% a year. And we've had a lot more inflation than 0.57% over the last 3 years. So I guess one of the things it's important to understand at this point, if you have stocks and bonds, they're both down, and the bonds are probably down more than the stocks, which is contrary to much of the ancient wisdom that has been handed down and is false, but sounds really good, that if you have a mixture of stocks and bonds, you'll have a smooth ride in the market and you'll be able to retire comfortably. Doesn't work that way. As a matter of fact, those bonds that are down 11.24%, I got to looking at samples of them and their average price out there. This is a scary thing. They're still trading above 100. What does that mean? That means that if you hold them to maturity, you will lose money on the principal, the average bond issued by an S&P 500 company. Sounds all gloomy and doomy. It's not. This is just the nature of investing in markets. You're going to have periods of time when this kind of thing happens. Last market that we follow and report on is the West Texas Intermediate crude oil. It's didn't do much of anything for the week. It's at $120.50 a barrel, which means, for whatever it's worth, that you're not going to see gas prices come down anytime soon. And we can talk at great length about why you're not going to see gas prices come down anytime soon. But the primary reason, the very primary reason, is the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine and Europe is cutting off the purchases of oil from Russia. Russia is largely blockaded. Gas prices have gone up even more. Natural gas prices have gone up even more, and particularly in Europe. And it boils down to somewhere between 10 and 12% of the petroleum that the world uses has vanished from the market, and we have increased our demand, so the price went up.
We have a minor piece of good news in the form of bad news.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major liquid natural gas export facilities had a major issue and hasn't been able to pump liquid natural gas into ships, and that's a problem. It's a problem for Europe, but it's caused natural gas prices in the United States to drop for a temporary period of time, because if you can't send it over there where they're paying more for it, we've got more here. The price came down.
Yeah, but that's only going to be
it's very temporary.
Get it started.
It's very temporary. In fact, they're putting up more and more liquid natural gas facilities. And as I mentioned last week, rig counts are up year over year for like who's pumping. But this week, like last week, we had it was flat. And the week before that, it was flat. The week before that, we had one extra. This week, we've got 30 more rigs coming online in North America. And these are big rigs. These aren't the little pumps that you see. These are the really, really big pumping facilities. Sometimes whole fields are called one rig in this report. But that's saying that the prices are finally high enough that people are getting serious about pumping faster. It's also, they've finally gotten high enough that they can hire the people at the wages that they're demanding to get pumping faster, because wages are high too. So that's good news for next year, and that if we continue to increase the pumping capability to bring on more rigs at this 30 a week type rate for a while, we're already like in North America last year, there were a total of 554 rigs online working. Now there's 874. So that's a lot more. That's 350 more rigs working now than were then a year ago. That's nearly double. But if we're bringing them on at 30 a week, where we've been kind of bringing them on sporadically here and there, it means that we're upping the capability to pump more, which long-term will bring prices down. I think if I do my math right here, the prices should be down either just before or just after the next presidential election. So it may have some bearing.
Well, I'm going to make a forecast. A year from now, inflation will be substantially lower.
I totally agree with that forecast.
I let me put a percentage on that. I want to say a 90% chance. There's a 10% chance that something weird will happen that we can't possibly guess or forecast.
Right.
But the high probability is that a year from now, interest rates will be high, inflation will be low. And this is sort of interesting, I think. Around 2024, it is my expectation the Fed will start lowering interest rates. They'll pump them up, inflation will go down, and then they will start backing down. Now, will they get back down as low as they are today?
No.
No.
Not unless we have a completely new form of the pandemic hit.
Generally speaking, at this point, short-term interest rates that the Fed controls directly probably need to be around 3%. I think they'll probably take them a little above 3% by the end of this year, the beginning of next year, and then they will back down. 3% is neutral. That means that interest rates in the future will be higher in all likelihood than they are today, but not as high as they're going to get. There was some discussion. I read some discussion, people jumping in and buying bonds said the Fed will have to lower rates in 2024. Yeah, but they won't lower them back down to where they are today. So the rates will still be higher then, which means bonds you buy today will be worth less in 2024 after they lower the rates than you buy them today. There is if the bond market were the stock market, it would be absolutely burning headlines that the bond market is crashing. There is panic selling went on Friday. I told you that there wasn't panic selling went on in the stock market, but there is evidence of panic selling in the bond market. And I think that's probably going to continue. What does that mean for you? Well, if you're going to hold a bond to me, you hold an individual bond and you're going to hold it to maturity. It means that you will get your money back minus inflation, which means you're losing over the last year, you lost about 8.1% in that bond because of inflation. If you got a bond fund and it's long term, anything other than an ultra short term bond fund, you're probably going to feel some pretty severe pain when you look at the values as time goes by.
Yeah. We've got some questions hanging out there.
Sure.
The questions we have, a couple of them from Inquisitor John. Neither of them include the Wall Street Journal, by the way. There is not a picture of the Wall Street Journal in any of these questions.
He's breaking his pattern.
I may cry tonight. I don't know. His question is pretty simple. TIPS versus I-bonds, pros and cons. What are they? What are we talking about here? Okay. What's a TIP? There is no such thing as a TIP. There's only TIPS. Treasury.
It's like there's no such thing as a pant.
Right. There's only pants.
There's only pants.
TIPS are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. They're relatively new, though if you're millennial and younger, you're going to think they've been around forever. A relatively new type of security where the U.S. Treasury adds an inflation index to it. They typically use the CPI-U, which is not what the Federal Reserve uses. It's not what most people use, but it's a good number to use if you're going to be consistent. So they're using it. TIPS, they come in different flavors. You've got the 5-year version, the 10-year version, and the 30-year version, and you can buy them just about anywhere. If you've got a Robinhood app or an E-Trade app, or you go to Merrill Lynch or AG Edwards or anywhere else, you can say, I want some TIPS in my portfolio, and you'll have choices directly from the Treasury through this system. An I-bond comes in one flavor. It's actually called a Series I savings bond. It's a 30-year bond. Now, why is that a big difference? Well, number one, it keeps paying at the interest that it's got marked on it, which changes every 6 months or so, forever, till 30 years. Where the TIPS might mature at a 5-year, a 10-year, or a 30-year. So that's not that big a difference, those two things. The number one difference is how you buy it. You have to go directly to the U.S. Treasury Department to buy Series I savings bond. It's treasurydirect.gov. It's also linked to the same inflation index, but it's applied twice a year instead of monthly. What's the difference? Well, it means that if you have a period of high inflation and it happens to be right on the right month that they're doing the measurement, you can have 6 months of really high interest payments on an I-bond where a TIP might be fluctuating up and down with whatever's going on. Right now, they're both paying a lot of interest. What were you going to add?
There's something about TIPS that is really important to understand. And you can check out the S&P 500 TIPS index. Even though TIPS are supposed to compensate you for high inflation,
right?
The S&P 500 TIPS index so far this year is down 5.63% with full interest reinvested.
And this is where I was actually going with that.
Okay.
What I was just saying, they're indexed monthly for the inflation. So it's like the interest rate should be keeping up with inflation. And where I was going is that the other big part of this that fits into it on where you can buy it, because the number one difference between these two things is where and how you can buy them. It's also where and how you can sell them. Because you can sell them at any point. If it's a TIPS, you can sell it on the market. You can just say, hey, I want to sell this thing. And if interest rates are up right now from when you got them, you're going to lose money on it. Where a Series I savings bond, you have to go back to the Treasury to sell it. And you can't sell it in the first 12 months. You can't sell it at all. And after 12 months, if you sell it, you'll lose a quarter of interest unless you've held it for 5 years. Then you don't lose anything when you sell it. So there's a lot more restrictions on an I-bond, but it doesn't fluctuate in value. Well, why doesn't it fluctuate in value? Because there's only one buyer and one seller for it. If you're the buyer, you bought it directly from the Treasury. And if you're the seller, you sold it directly to the Treasury. There's only one place to get and receive from to sell. And that means that the principal value is much more stable, at least on paper. I mean, you could turn and sell it to your grandma, but Treasury Direct's not going to recognize that your grandma owns it unless you died. Excuse me. So those are the big issues. There's some other stuff, like the taxes are different on it. On TIPS, you get paid, even though it's indexed monthly, you get paid twice a year. And you owe income tax on that interest. Even if the the value of it is down, if you got paid interest, you're going to owe taxes on that interest as if it's income. Where with an I bond, an I series, series I, you don't have to take that interest. It's loaded into the bond itself. So when you go to sell it, that's when you owe your taxes on it. There's some other fine details on that, but those are the two big things. I bonds are clunkier, harder to buy, harder to sell, more stable. TIPS are more sophisticated and easier to buy and sell. And you've got something to add to this?
Bonds are very complicated, and TIPS bonds are even more complicated. But this is an important thing to recognize about TIPS bonds, the bonds themselves that are currently offered by the Treasury, the ones that they're offering right now. The actual interest rate is 0.125%, which is not much. It is the adjustment of the underlying principal in arrears for inflation that gives them their value.
Yeah, and that's the part. You may owe income tax on adjusted principal in TIPS where you don't until you sell on the I bond. Yeah, so what's an adjusted principal? Say you bought it for $100. It's not a good number to buy it with, but I'm going to say it anyway. And inflation's affected it. It's still worth $100, but those dollars are worth less than they were. So the federal government goes in and adds some extra money to your principal. So now it's like you invested $104, or in this climate, $108. And when that $8 might be taxable, though, even though it's inflation. Yeah.
From a practical point of view, and this is the esoteric knowledge behind this makes my brain quiver. If you invested in a portfolio of new TIPS bonds or in the secondary market TIPS bonds at the beginning of the year, your portfolio with all interest and adjustments by the Treasury and everything else would still be down 5.63% today. So even though the TIPS bonds, now when you compare what it's done over the last year, and this is where the attraction comes in. I told you the S&P 500 bond index is down about 11.24%. The TIPS index, the S&P 500 TIPS index is down 1.94% over the last year. So you would have only lost 1.94% over the last year, according to the S&P 500 TIPS index, if you'd had that particular portfolio. You look surprised.
Yeah, I didn't know there was an S&P 500 stock or TIPS index because it's...
Yeah, there is. It
doesn't make any really, sense.
It doesn't. Well, it's not. It doesn't take it from the S&P 500 companies because they obviously... It's actually called the S&P... I'm sorry.
It's US
S&P
TIPS.
US TIPS index.
I was very confused there.
It's S&P US TIPS index. It lost 0.45% on Friday. So if you get into TIPS bonds, you've still got some significant market risk. If you get into I bonds, Treasury, go to Treasury Direct and buy savings bonds that are I series, you have no market risk. TIPS bonds, as interest rates go up, tend to lose money, which doesn't make a lot of sense if according to the theory behind TIPS, but it does anyway. Because interest rates go up because inflation went up and they tend to lose money. And when inflation or interest rates are going up, and inflation and interest rates are going up. By the way, bonds, the only place I have seen bonds do anything other than lose money this year is in ultra short inflation protected securities. So that's just where it is. I mean, that's just life. The markets, as interest rates go up, bonds lose money. It's a matter of how much money they lose in this case. Interest rates go down, they make money.
We just got more questions in. One is on solar. We've got the soft landing question, but we've got to play some commercials first.
Yeah, and I'll do the soft landing.
Yeah. We've got email addresses in here. We are reading them and answering them as we come to them. The email addresses, if you've got questions, are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we've got to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, the email addresses in here are Jeff at TPWC.com and Jake at TPWC.com. You've got a question on soft landing, and I just got one on when is a good idea to use solar energy with specific questions on the personal finance side. So I'll have some really good answers on that. Anyway, okay. Go ahead.
Okay, the soft landing. Let's talk about what a soft landing is. As a matter of fact, the Fed has been talking about, or Chairman Powell actually was talking about, a soft-ish landing, which is probably closer to what we'll get. A soft landing is reducing inflation without creating a major recession. And it has been done actually quite a few times in history. It has not been done several times, but the several times when it was not done, I don't think there was any intention of creating a soft landing. Paul Volcker created two major recessions to take out major inflation. If inflation is endemic to the economy, in other words, if consumer expectations are that inflation will continue to rise, and so they are demanding pay raises in anticipation of inflation, and people are buying things immediately when they come on to the market for sale, buy now, pay later, because they are convinced prices will go up in the future, that is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It takes a hard landing, a recession, a lot of pain to squeeze that out of the economy historically. A soft landing is...
Can I say that in a different way?
Sure.
Just real quick. Inflation is 99% psychological, maybe 100%. I don't know. We'll quibble about that last 1%. It is psychological in that when you want something so much, you're willing to pay more for it, no matter if it's... That's what I mean, is that if you say, no, I won't pay more than X for this thing, and we all know people that say, nope, I'm not buying that candy bar anymore. It's not 25 cents. Whatever. That just means they haven't bought a candy bar in a long time, by the way. That's the psychological part of it. And when you expect prices to go up, it influences the prices. If everybody expects it, then it influences the prices. And it has to be a really hard smack in the face, basically, for you to stop expecting that. And that's what a hard landing is. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and there's really no way of telling whether we're going to have a hard landing or a soft landing, because there's a lot of things that are totally out of control of the Fed. The goal of the Fed right now, at least according to the voting members of the Federal Reserve Board who have been speaking in public, is to raise interest rates very slightly above neutral. Now, what's neutral? Well, that's generally to be considered to be 3.25% right now. And at the same time, to shrink their balance sheet, which is to basically absorb, by doing so, without getting into the mechanics of it, it absorbs money from the economy, takes money out of the system. And once savings come down a little bit and things return back to normal in the system, about the same time, there is a reasonable probability that we will have more oil, as Jake talked about, coming online. We'll have more gasoline being produced. China will finally stop locking down and start producing the things we need to make things here. Even as we start making more things here than we were making that previously were made in China, it's a very complex situation underway, operation underway right now. But the United States economy, particularly, and maybe to a lesser degree, the world economy, is self-healing as long as there is a large degree of free trade and free enterprise going on. And there is. The end result of that is, if interest rates go up, it becomes more expensive to borrow money to build things. For example, Tesla is building a big plant down in Austin, almost done with it. They're not done with it by now, and that will make more cars, so there's more stuff to buy. That's a prime example that anyone who's driven to the airport has seen. They had to borrow money to build that plant. Now, if they wanted to build another plant and interest rates are higher, it'll cost them a lot more to borrow money, so they're less likely to build another plant, which means they're less likely to make more stuff, which means they'll hire more people. So the trick for the Fed, and the problem with what the Fed has done in the past sometimes, is just as they get the brakes put on the economy enough to slow it down, the economy also is slowing down on its own. And they are fully aware that that type of thing tends to happen And so they have been relatively cautious, and they're getting a lot of flack for being relatively cautious about raising rates. This particular set of inflationary issues that is going on today is quite different from anything we have seen before. It has some degree of parallel back in the 1970s with the Arab oil embargo.
It's some parallel with the 1940s after World War II.
Right. So, but it's not the same thing at all. So inflation is not entrenched in people's minds in the economy. It's still shocking. If we have 8% inflation and it's running along at 8% and we've finally gotten used to the fact that it's 8% and it doesn't make headlines anymore, we're in trouble.
Yeah, and that's not the case right now. The headlines, I was just telling you, I was reading the economy section of the Wall Street Journal. In the top 15 or top 20 headlines, two of them are not about inflation. That's huge. That means that we are all very aware of it and don't like it.
Right. And my experience personally in my very tiny world of observing is that spending is slowing. Now, I see also indications in the economy that spending is slowing. And you can see it very in written in relatively large letters. Our import numbers for the last month dropped 19%. What does that mean? That means we're buying less stuff from overseas.
Yeah. And
we're probably buying less stuff here too.
Applications for new mortgages fell 6.5% 1 week over 1 week, but it's about 40% less than a year ago at the same time. 40% less. That's huge.
And it's 7% drop in for the mortgage applications where they're actually buying houses. So,
right.
So we have this declining demand. It's the interest rates and the prices together tend to push demand down. Now, if people have access to lots of money and they don't care, they're just going to keep buying. I personally have noticed that I am clumping. We live in Salado, and for instance, there are certain things we buy in Harker Heights because that's where we buy them, and that's the only place we can get them reasonably. We clump our trips to Harker Heights together pretty tightly, and we're out of time for this hour.
Yeah, saving on gas. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we've got another hour coming up. You've got email and voicemail. Voicemail is local at
947-1111, 254-947-1111.
Toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Jeff and or Jake at tpwc.com. And you can also find our radio programs, newsletters, and so on the webpage. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.